This is episode 1 Echo of the Software Freedom Law Show for January 5th, 2010. Hi, this is Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn, and you've tuned in to the Software Freedom Law Show.
I think this time we're going to jump right into it.
Right into an exciting interview of philosophical and thoughtful debate.
With an exciting guest.
Enjoy it. So, Karen, we have our first ever second time guest today.
And what's great about it is that this first time, second time guest used to be one of our coworkers.
That's correct.
So it's perfectly appropriate for a first time, second time guest.
It's been a few years since he worked here. He's currently at Red Hat, where your title is, what's your title there, Richard, these days?
It's still Open Source Licensing and Patent Counsel.
Okay, so this interview stemmed from how excited I was to see your speech this summer at OSCON, where you talked about some really interesting ideas about how the legal system around free software works. And it was unique in the kinds of talks you often see at OSCON, because it was actually talking about somewhat new legal theory to some extent, legal analysis, which was kind of neat. And that's rare at OSCON, I think.
And I had to miss the talk. I think we may have actually been talking against each other. I'm not sure.
No, you were right after his, but I think there was a talk you had to go to right before that or something like that.
Oh, it may have been right after, too.
Yeah.
But so I'd really like to hear all about it.
Oh, you were at the meeting prepping for your panel, Karen. That's what it was.
I think so.
Because she had a panel right after it. But anyway, we're going to get, hopefully, a summary of that. So do you want to sort of introduce the topic and the ideas that you were talking about to our guests, to our listeners, rather?
Sure. I think the ideas that I still wrestle with and that kind of led to this OSCON talk, there's a lot of different ideas, and they're sort of not necessarily all worked out yet. But basically, I'm thinking about the relationship between free software licensing and the background, what I'll call intellectual property law, principally copyright law, I suppose, but other areas of law as well that govern software licensing, and what is the relationship between them. And so that was my first time at OSCON, but I understand that in past years there have been some talks from lawyers or non-lawyers. And I think last summer there was a similar talk by someone that just gives an introduction to, you know, the what we call intellectual property law, so copyrights, patents, trademarks, and it kind of introduces developers to the basic legal concepts in those areas. And I'm kind of coming at it from a different perspective, because I often think that those bodies of law don't fit in well with free software licensing law. And I speak of licensing law because I think it is its own legal system in a sense, and that's partly what my talk was about. Can we think about free software licensing as a kind of separate legal system that really is quite independent of the background legal system of copyright and so forth that we assume controls the way these licenses work?
Well, it's somewhat strange to hear you say that, because I've sort of been taught from the very beginning by Richard Stallman and by Evan Moglen and so forth that our licenses actually function pretty directly against relatively standard copyright rules. So what do you mean by the licensing structure is extra or separate from the normal copyright rules?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a historical aspect to this that I think about a lot, the free software, so in a sense, the free software movement gets started around the time that Stallman announces the GNU project in the early 80s. But as Stallman has often pointed out, and as you, Bradley, have pointed out in some of your talks, actually free software is much older, and it's really as old as computing itself, and people have been sharing code and you know, creating a kind of code commons long before the free software movement was conceptualized. But for a long time, I think everyone assumed that the legal system just didn't apply to control that activity in any meaningful way. So, you know, it wasn't until the late 70s that it was clear that copyright applied to software in the United States. It wasn't really clear until sometime in the 80s that, you know, lots of software companies would be able to get patents on software-related inventions. And so the whole concept of software licensing doesn't really come into play until, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, around the time that, that copyright law is applied to software. So there's this prehistory in which it's assumed that this activity of free software really exists outside the legal system. And then you enter the second period where, you know, Stallman announces the GNU project and he starts to think about copyleft. And that, I think, is more describable as a kind of reaction against the legal system but sort of using the legal system against itself. And I think that's what you were describing, Bradley.
Right. And I think, but I guess what sort of trips us up when we hear it the first time is that, you know, when you're saying using the legal system against itself, it was actually a process of using the legal system. So from the way we traditionally think about it, we think about, you know, well, it basically adopts all the constructs and rules of copyright law and uses them to create a license that is wholly born out of copyright law.
Right.
So,
And I think this is certainly the conventional way of looking at it, and I think it's probably the dominant way that lawyers look at this today. But I just think that it's not completely satisfactory. So, why isn't it really completely work well? So, one issue is that free software licensing is a set of activities that involves many people all over the world, and no one can possibly trace the jurisdictional relationships between them. And yet, our systems of copyright law and other bodies of law that might govern interpretation of licenses, those systems are national. They're local law. So how do you sort of reconcile those things? When we think about, you know, how to interpret the GPL, we're not thinking about how it works in the U.S. versus how it works in a particular European country.
Wait a second, Richard, we are sometimes, right? We're thinking in terms of the Berne Convention, and a lot of the V3 process was to actually international. I probably would agree with you about V2, because I think that was written as a U.S. copyright license primarily. But V3, as you participated in the process extensively, was a license that made some attempts at least to be international and to think in terms of Berne Convention on copyright and other types of international ways of viewing copyright.
Well, yes, so that's what V3 looks like, and I think that was the intention. But when we think about analyzing or interpreting GPL V3, I don't think we really are approaching it any differently from how we look at V2. So we don't, you know, it's true that V3 tries to incorporate local copyright law and saying what the definition of propagate and convey is, and convey sort of replaces the term distribution in GPL V2. But in practice, when developers and distributors are thinking about how to understand GPL V3, they are not thinking about those local differences. They are probably assuming in general that, well, you know, all jurisdictions are going to reach some kind of more or less uniform, reasonable result, hopefully. And so that's why, and I think that's how we approach all free software licenses. We pretend, even though this is often not acknowledged, and I don't know if pretend is the right word, that there is a kind of international system not tied to particular, you know, differences in jurisdictions that governs what these licenses mean.
Well, yeah, I think I think you actually connected this up really interestingly in your talk, because I remember you spoke some about the issue of predictability and how legal systems, their most important aspect is their level of predictability, which we actually do have in the system because it does have this kind of grounding. So maybe you could talk more about how that issue of how predictable the free software legal system is for lawyers connects up with this apparent unpredictability that you're talking about. I think there's actually a balance there.
Right. So it's true that any working legal system has to have some good degree of predictability. And I think part of the predictability that exists in free software licensing comes from this international character, this absence of real close ties to particular jurisdictional rules. And so when people try to understand the GPL, a lot of people look to the FSF's GPL FAQ and what Stallman may have said or Eben Moglen has said over the years about how the GPL applies in a particular situation. And this is very helpful for people. And regardless of what country they are in, and regardless of what the copyright rules and other legal rules of their country's laws would say about that analysis. And I think it actually guides the behavior of people in different countries. So I think that the predictability that does exist in free software licensing is partly a function of this refusal to be tied down by the details of a particular local legal system.
So you're sort of saying that regardless of what the, I'm going to say local jurisdiction, but that is just a lawyer's way of saying whatever country you're in. So, that's not the one that, so if I'm a U.S. lawyer, I'm going to say a local jurisdiction, and that could just mean any other country. So somebody in another country would just, maybe not think about or discard or treat as secondary the way in which the license might be interpreted under their own rules, because they would put greater weight upon the intentions of the original drafter?
Well, that's sometimes how it is characterized. So I think there's a distinction, I guess, we should make between how free software developers understand the licenses that they use and how lawyers come to understand those licenses as well. I think maybe those are two different things. And obviously, lawyers are going to be more likely to worry about this problem of how to reconcile the folk understanding of what the licenses mean with what they think their legal systems say they should mean.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I've observed that particular issue in a very specific way for a long time in the free software community. You have a tendency of that kind of folk understanding. For example, the LGPL is the LGPL V2 specifically I'm talking about, not the good one that you wrote, Richard, but the V2 one that has some issues. There is a folk understanding of LGPL V2 that sometimes differs somewhat wildly from what the text actually says. And generally speaking, we defer to that folk understanding because it's usually more closer to the drafter's intent than what the license actually says. There's things in LGPL V2 that say things like you have to change notices and various things that people tend not to do because it's bad practice for a variety of other reasons. And people have a general understanding of how you combine LGPL works and GPL works that don't necessarily match the letter of the law, but they match the drafter's intent. And so I think there is that folk understanding. I think what the legal system, as lawyers have gotten interested in this licensing, has done is help give some certainty, predictability, and clarity to what that folk understanding was. I think that's the real contribution the legal folks have made.
But you're also bundling in this secondary idea of establishing a practice of enforcement. And, what the copyright holder might do to enforce their license is, establishes expectations that may be also extraneous from the law.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's certainly true, and that's there's nothing really new about that idea. That is completely harmonizable with this idea, the idea that we have to focus on, we figure out what law applies, what jurisdictional law applies, what national version of copyright law applies, and then apply it to a particular licensing situation. Because it's true that if you have a license that says one thing and you have a pattern of activity by particular licensors ignoring that term, that does create expectations, and I think that has legal meaning.
Are you saying that's some sort of estoppel argument? That's why it has legal meaning?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, in some legal systems, maybe you could argue that there's an estoppel theory in, you know, maybe you can, but I don't know if you even need to get into, you know, reaching into traditional concepts of particular legal systems. I don't know if there's a concept of estoppel in civil law systems, for example. There probably is something equivalent. But I think, you know, there's something more basic going on with the example of the LGPL, which is that, you know, everyone using the LGPL has ignored that aspect of, I think it's Section 3 of LGPL 2.x, which says, you know, if you want to combine LGPL license code with GPL license code, you can do so, but you have to alter all the notices.
Yep.
This has been completely ignored, and for good policy reasons, as you pointed out, Bradley, but that has shaped the meaning of the license in the communities that use that license. And I think that creates its own kind of legal rule. And so this is what I mean when I say that there is a kind of separate legal system that has risen up that is sort of independent of any of the underlying national legal systems that gives meaning to these licenses.
I think the place that people are going to take issue with that, and I think where I take, Karen and I probably both take somewhat issue with, is calling it a legal system per se. I think what you're describing is actually a system of standards and practices that work within the legal systems we have, the copyright system and so forth, that help the community function in a way that, okay, well, we understand that particular section of LGPL v2, section 3 of LGPL v2 was not really the best way to write it, and therefore we've generally considered it not something people need to comply with. They can just combine by putting notice at the top of the program saying, ah, this whole program is GPL'd, even though some things are marked as LGPL because we're distributing as a whole, a single work. I think it's more of a standards and practice question than it is an extra legal system.
Yeah, I mean that's true. I think I mean, there's other aspects of this that this world of free software licensing that make me like to describe it as a kind of separate legal system, and so you know, one is that it's hard to there are interpretations of the GPL that have risen up in the free software community, and it's hard to reconcile those interpretations completely satisfactorily with, you know, U.S. case law and copyright law, for example. And some, you know, some people worry about this. Some lawyers like to worry about this. But this is not really, I don't think this has concerned developers licensing code under the GPL, because so some developers do try to research case law and for a particular country. It's generally the U.S. But for the most part, there's a set of discussions that have taken place over many years about, you know, how the GPL applies in particular fact patterns, situations, that doesn't even refer to to case law. This is the aspect of custom or tradition that I have pointed out before, that there's a set of that free software license that can be seen as a system of traditions or customs that, you know, either supplement the underlying legal system or, in a sense, supplant it or replace it. And my point about lex mercatoria, I've compared free software licensing to this concept called lex mercatoria, which was in the Middle Ages in Europe. Merchants developed their own system of law, basically, because there were legal systems in particular countries. They were very primitive legal systems, and they weren't really satisfactory for governing the kind of transactions that these merchant traders needed to be regulated. So they developed their own system to, in a sense, bypass the local legal system. And they documented the system. They developed their own dispute resolution institutions. And in turn, this system of Lex Mercatoria influenced the local legal systems later on. And today, so for example, U.S. commercial law, most U.S. states have something called the Uniform Commercial Code. And this the rules in this code are, many of them are based ultimately on Lex Mercatoria, going back, you know, hundreds of years. And I think that there's something I like to see as analogous in the free software world.
Yeah, I love the analogy, and I think it's really interesting and colorful. I guess the one thing that I sort of hesitate over is that I think that, you know, that we're talking about a system that's not separate or different or disparate from our current legal regime. Maybe just for practicality, we'll talk about the United States, in particular. But in fact, a lot of these decisions or a lot of these rules and customs and practices have come out of interpretations of what, you know, of what lawyers and others think that the legal system would, you know, what conclusions would we come to in the ordinary course of our legal system based on, you know, what we already have in place in the absence of established rulemaking. And I find this really interesting right now because I think we're sort of starting to see that in the context of the Jacobson case and other what I experienced during the ALI process and the way that lawyers are thinking about the issues that have been talked about with free software are actually quite similar to, or part of that system of practices that arose. But I wonder if it's, you know, what the chicken and egg factor is there. Like, is it just because, you know, in fact, this is what the law was all along and therefore it's just best, you know, sort of a best effort by lawyers and others to interpret them and explain them without referring to case law to people who wouldn't care about hearing about case law.
Yeah, so, I think one aspect of this is that for a long time, very few lawyers were involved in any of this at all. So these traditions around free software licensing and traditional practices and standards, they grew up at a time when few developers had any access to a lawyer. Now, Richard Stallman was one developer who did have access to a lawyer pretty early on. And, I know that he had lawyers help him write GPLv2. And I think I understand that he consulted a lawyer when the dispute over the next Objective-C compiler came up, which I think was in the late 80s. That was one of the earliest GPL controversies. And so Richard Stallman had access to a lawyer. I'm not sure who that lawyer was, maybe Jerry Cohen. But most people participating in the free software world did not. And so I think that the understandings about these licenses have developed really without benefit, if benefit is the right word, of access to lawyers. And I think that the influence of lawyers on understanding the system is a relatively recent phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't disagree with all of that. I probably disagree with some of that. I think you are correct that there wasn't heavy access to lawyers, basically. Stallman got advice in the way that he wrote GPLv2 and was assisted directly during V2's drafting by Jerry Cohen, at least Jerry Cohen's firm. I don't know if it was Jerry Cohen himself. So that's certainly true, but I think that Stallman, for his own part, has a very deep understanding of how copyright law worked and researched it heavily to make sure, for no other reason, that copyleft would actually work, which it does, as it turns out. So there is that issue of it, and I think that there's certain inadequacies in V2 that we do see because of the time that it was written as opposed to the way it was written. Because there's a lot of things that are confusing about online distribution because online distribution wasn't really common then and so forth. So there are those issues. And I think we develop standards and practices around those. And then as we update V3, we start to embody those standards and practices into the improvements. So I think where we're having our fundamental disagreement, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I think the fundamental disagreement that I see there is that that I don't think it's a separate system, and I don't think it's a system in conflict. It almost seems like you're saying that the system is somehow working separate, outside of, above, around the existing system, which as a philosophy it is, because copyleft is innovation, but as reality of how it actually operates on a day-to-day level. I think it's working within the system, just creating novel things and having new things come up that slowly, as Karen's pointing out, like in the AI process, people are coming to realize what I think hackers understood a long time ago about how the stuff should work. Lawyers are starting to codify it and build it into a legal structure. Actually, very similar to the example you're giving, where we look at the descendant of historical law. What gets written into law was the standards and practices before there was law.
Right. So, I don't want to push the point too much. I think it's a useful kind of thought experiment to think about free software as existing somehow outside the conventional legal system. And one reason we've been able to do this, or at least I don't know who else is kind of thinking about this way except for me, but one reason why it's been possible to think about it in this way is that there has not been until recently, there haven't been a lot of use of the court system by free software licensors. I mean, I think prior to the 2000s, as far as I know, there wasn't. But that means that for many years, people were trying to figure out what these licenses meant without resorting to the courts. And there were disputes over what the licenses meant that were resolved outside the court system. And so we haven't had any kind of we don't have case law on free software licensing, at least until the Jacobson decision. And I guess in Germany there is some case law now. And I don't know to what degree that shapes the law in Germany relating to how you understand the GPL. But so it's been possible to think about free software as a kind of extra legal system because there's been so little use of the courts up until recently. And so I agree that I think this is probably changing, and it may change in the future. We may get a lot more case law, and we may get more and more lawyers interested in this subject, and they may influence how we think about these issues. So that may shape how in the future people think about all this. And I think that the effect might be a kind of harmonization of the underlying local legal system with what I call the free software legal system. But I don't know.
Yeah, see what I think is actually happening, especially when you talk about obviously we filed litigation recently with regard to GPL enforcement, and everybody knows that I do have focused a lot on tons of GPL enforcement in my life. And what actually ends up happening is the ones that are getting litigated are ones where they aren't any of the border cases. That's the funny thing. If you read our compliance guide, I talk about this extensively. I think many of us wrote it, but I think I wrote the section that made the first draft of the section that says it turns out that the things that are compliance problems are never the stuff that lawyers like to debate about. Lawyers like to debate fun stuff.
I think this has actually been a theme through many of our podcast episodes have been, you know, that it turns out we lawyers tend not to disagree about the vast majority of the issues that arise in free software in enforcement or compliance or there are a few very interesting issues that come up, but those aren't necessarily fundamental to like the way free software licenses and the GPL in particular operate.
Right, and it's always more fun to debate these border issues, but those are not really the ones that are going to be tested or even ultimately questioned, because people are going to err on the side of conservatism, particularly lawyers who are well known to err on the side of conservatism about interpreting things. So it's unlikely that one of these dicey cases of derivative works, for example, is ever going to get.
I don't know that that's unlikely that that we'll get one of these edge cases eventually, especially as there's more and more varied adoption of free software in all different kinds of enterprise.
Okay,
I think you know we might see that because we see people we see a lot more lawyers involved, and we see a lot more pushing of the edge cases.
So the fact that I've often thought about that comment that Bradley made in that guideline document, the questions that lawyers like to worry about or think about or talk about are really not the ones that are likely to come up in practice in significant enforcement.
I have to tell you,
cases.
Richard, to interrupt you, I'm sorry, but if you're taking issue with that, you're also taking issue with Karen Copenhaver's statement in her IFOS article.
I have not read that.
All right, well, go ahead and take us all to task, Richard. Come on, let's hear it.
No, so I think Bradley's correct. But this, I think, reinforces the point I was making that you know, we aren't likely to see a lot of case law in the foreseeable future that's going to address some of the difficult questions that Bradley, you may say, are not that important from an enforcement perspective, and I understand that. But I think the questions that developers on free software projects worry about, and I think they sincerely worry about them, are different from the questions that arise in those enforcement cases. So I think that some of the questions of derivative works are questions that free software community developers really take seriously and really think very hard about in many cases.
But the thing that the lawyers and developers don't always have tons in common, but one thing they've got in common deeply is they hate working on boring stuff. They want to talk and debate about the exciting stuff. So I think you may be seeing a mirror of what's happening in the legal world, which is developers, you look at something like Debian Legal, they love it when there's something new to discuss that they haven't seen before and they have to debate it, and it's a border case. The AGPL thread that I was involved with on Debian Legal is a great example of that. Oh, AGPL, can Debian ever comply with AGPL for this, that, and the other reason, right? So I think, but that's the AGPL compliance issue doesn't come up nearly as much as no source or offer in some binary firmware, right? So I think even developers like to debate the same types of border questions that just don't come up that often.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really talking about two different things, though. So I am not, when I talk about the free software as a legal system analogous to Lex Mercatoria, I'm not even thinking about those firmware vendors, because I see them as outside this system. And I think that's where, you know, the conventional legal system maybe becomes more appropriately used or thought about. But I'm really talking about the world that free software projects are inhabiting. And so maybe some of this is kind of based on my experiences in the work I do with the Fedora project, because I'm often thinking about, you know, so Fedora has a policy of only distributing software that meets the FSF's free software definition. And figuring out what that means, because the FSF has only given a limited amount of its own views on what that means for particular licenses, is challenging. And there are also issues of GPL compatibility that come up in the Fedora packaging process that I wrestle with. And these are areas where I find that it is useful to think about the customary aspect of free software licensing, and where I find that if you think too much about the details of local legal systems, you know, it isn't always very helpful.
Yeah, I think there's two points I want to wrap that with. Is that one is that I think there's a certain amount of reasonableness that I think the free software world has generally engaged in, and despite what people think about Stallman historically or whatever, I think all of the interpretations FSF's given, I think the interpretations SFLC has been public about that it's been able to give, have really had a good sense of reasonableness. At least we've tried very hard to make them as reasonable as possible, which means that it's very easy to get consensus and less disagreement about it. The other thing I'd add is I think we may, our primary disagreement may be primarily a semantic one, because I think that we get all in a bunch about this, oh, well, wait a second, this you're saying it's not a legal system when we say it is. I think it's more of a semantical argument about what you call it. And I think that's a philosophical debate perhaps, but I think ultimately it's we're talking about standards and practices that fit within a legal system. I don't know, Karen, you want to add something to that?
No, I mean, I think I agree with you when you talk about standards and practice that fit within a legal system. And I'm intrigued by this idea, but at the same time, this is the first time I've heard about this. So I'm sort of drawing parallels between other areas of, you know, other non-free software related legal areas, and where you have issues that maybe don't rise to the level of making it to the legal system, where you have a rich experience of coming to customs and practices and understandings, and they fit well within the legal system. But I think that what the point that Richard's making is a slightly a different one and an interesting one, and that's you know in talking about how we think about pooling this body of information that we've been gathering and consensus that we've been developing, and I guess what's what the next question that I draw, and maybe because I'm peering ahead in the slides that you provided for me in advance that I think we'll make available in our show notes, if that's okay by you, Richard.
Sure.
How do we document that and share it so that we don't have to reproduce all of this work, that everybody can benefit from this body of understanding that we have?
Right. So that's where I have to admit that a lot of what I've been talking about is wishful thinking, because a real well-functioning legal system does have to be well documented. So, the U.S. legal system, which of course has many flaws, is a relatively well documented legal system. We have public legislation, public regulation. We have some access to public court decisions. And what is the counterpart to that in this free software legal system I've been talking about? Well, there isn't a lot that's great, unfortunately. If you're part of this system, of this culture, you may find it relatively intuitive to find sources of information, but even then I'm not so sure. But certainly for lawyers who are getting accustomed to this culture, it's not really obvious to them where to begin and where to look for guidance. And so there is no real good equivalent of case law because there are no cases that are published. It would be nice, for example, if the FSF or an organization like that, or SFLC, were to start publishing some information on fact patterns of enforcement cases that come up. And maybe that's not practical for various reasons, but I think this is something that many, both lawyers and developers, would find very helpful. So this is a real problem.
I think a lot of those fact patterns, sorry to interrupt, I think there's a lot of those fact patterns might be very boring, though. From what we actually see.
Well, and the same thing is...
Yeah, people, I gave a presentation about 6 or 7 years ago that was a series of fact patterns of GPL enforcement cases, and it put the entire CLE class to sleep. So I've never given that talk since.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess part of it is, what I find interesting is often different from what most lawyers find interesting. But...
I think that's a good thing.
An example comes that is sort of related to what we're talking about that I dealt with recently comes to mind, and this is a little bit, I think it's still on topic. So in Gnuplot, which has nothing to do with GNU from what I understand, there is some source file that says, the copyright holder of this file decided to place his code into the public domain, and I have an email from him that records this. And a question came up, how do we deal with this, and how do we understand this? Does this create a problem for this code? And there's a lot of controversy over whether you can even release code into the public domain in particular countries, or if there's a certain way that you have to do it to be effective. And the Creative Commons now has this CC0, I guess it's not really a license, that is kind of a reaction to those concerns. But there is code like this throughout lots of free software projects. A lot of legacy code and sometimes non-legacy code says, I hereby release this into the public domain. And if we start worrying about, whether that's effective in Germany versus in the United States, we would have to start questioning the usableness of large bodies of free software code, and we have never questioned this. In a sense, in terms of our actions, we treat public domain source code as free software. The FSF has always had the position that public domain source code is a form of free software, and I think that that's right, and that's part of that reasonableness that Bradley was talking about. But I think where I might differ with Bradley is I think these reasonable conclusions about particular legal issues that come up are not necessarily efforts to apply the formal rules of the underlying legal system to a particular situation. Rather, they are efforts to find the reasonable result and to assume that it's harmonizable with whatever the underlying legal system says.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct that some of the thought process go that way, and certainly I do that first, because primarily because I'm not a lawyer. I think through the reasonableness of a particular policy, but of course I've learned long ago that checking that against the legal systems of various jurisdictions is really important. And I think the internationalization effort in V3 was part of trying to do that. And I think the CC0 effort by Creative Commons is part of trying to do that. As a side note on CC0, I've had trouble getting developers to like it because they want a thing that's one sentence that says public domain. And they don't really want to spend the time because they're like, well, I was putting in the public domain because I don't want to deal with a license. And then CC0 ultimately is a disclaimer, then a fallback license if disclaimers don't work, and various other interacting parts like that. I think the difficulty that we have is that to go back to Lessig's point of code being law, right? We've got this situation in the free software world where the hackers are making the rules to some extent, based on reasonableness. And we do have to harmonize that with the legal system. I think that's essential. And that's, I think what a lot of us are doing. And that's sort of what we're here doing debating is mm-hmm. how to harmonize the tradition of free software with the legal systems we have.
Right. I think maybe the difference between us is that I think that in some cases, the underlying legal systems have to catch up with free software. And I think maybe you guys might be saying that free software, maybe the burden is more on free software to make sure its rules are harmonized with the underlying legal system.
I think it's a give and take.
Yeah, and yeah. I think maybe we're saying they're not necessarily out of harmonization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think it's generally the case that if you look at the case law of just software, just like forget the free software, but just think of software, proprietary software. If you look at the history of case law, it's all about harmonizing what people were doing with that. And I think when you look at the history of the patent cases, which we recently did with regard to Bilski, those patent cases that led up to Bilski were various different cases, which, because I'm not a lawyer, I can't name off the top of my head. when Aaron and I did our little podcast about that, we talked about how they were slowly trying to harmonize business practices with the patent law. So I think that's part of the process of building a legal system. So I just think we're a young enough community that we're still in the middle of that process. But I think it's gone on before. I think your real analogy there to the tradition is that they eventually got harmonized, and they eventually got things that weren't harmonized were written into law. And I think we're heading in that direction if we have to. From my point of view, that we're going to build a system that works to create the freedom of software and works with all the laws that are around there. So I think that's where this discussion can hopefully lead.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think, as I said, this is a kind of thought experiment, but of course, ultimately, you have local legal systems, you have local systems of copyright law, and enforcement of these licenses through the courts are probably going to be based on application of local copyright law in some way or other. Mm-hmm. And so in the long run, you're going to have to ground the customary rules of free software in the underlying legal framework. And so I think where there are conflicts, I think what's probably going to happen is that local law will be revised and will be modified in order to take account of these traditions, much as law often gets revised to reflect business practices that have come up.
So I think that's a good place to sort of end this discussion for now. We're happy to have had you as our second time guest, and I was glad we were able to get some more into these philosophical discussions about legal mm-hmm. issues, because last time we didn't get enough time to do that, so now we've done that part of it. So I'm really glad that you were able to join us for that.
Thanks. It was a real privilege to be on again.
Well, we're privileged to have you. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks.
That was really fun. I miss having those kinds of conversations with Richard around our office.
I used to have a lot more with him, too.
I know.
We probably wasted too much time on that, to tell you the
truth. Well, you were establishing important theories for the analysis of free software interpretation. I wouldn't say like free software license interpretation or, you know.
We had some theories. That's true.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about that, about what Richard had said in the brief time since we've talked to him, is that, you know, he was talking about those public domain grants and whether or not they're enforceable. So just saying, you know, I put this work in the public domain, And I was thinking that, you know, one of the things that he didn't mention, and I know that he thinks of too, is that there's some degree of risk analysis involved in that. So it's not always a matter of, you know, is this grant legally enforceable, and you know, do we interpret that as part of our rules and practices as being adequate? It's often a situation of, well, what are the risks if we include it? What are the downsides? And sometimes the answer is, you know, well, the worst case scenario actually isn't that bad. So there's, you know, we may as well include it. Although other times that same analysis could go in a different way.
And there's also a history of risk analysis. So on the public domain example, people have been using that as a disclaimer way of putting stuff into free software of any license for so many years. People's risk assessment of that is relatively low because it's been working for 20 years, 23 years, and mm-hmm. No, there's never been a problem. I've never heard of a situation where somebody came back and said, no, you can't do this because, in fact, that person who said it was in the public domain is in Germany, and therefore they had moral rights, which were not waived. And yeah, I mean, you could theorize this might happen. It's never happened in 23 years, 24 years.
The risks are low, and sometimes when the risks are low, it doesn't even matter that much what, you know, or it's not that it doesn't matter, but it, you know, the legal weight of what the appropriate analysis would be is much lessened.
Yeah, this is something I think Debian Legal struggles with as a community. When they debate issues, they think of these things in terms of the way programmers would, which is either it compiles and passes the test suite or it doesn't. And if it fails one test in the test suite, well, the software is wrong. And I don't think you can make legal analyses like that. Even if it fails a test, if that test is some risk that's only going to happen 0.001% of the time, you shouldn't spend the next 2 years trying to make the software fit that test and pass that test.
That said, what's interesting is that a lawyer will also not be able to give you an opinion or tell you you can do something when there's a risk. It's just a lawyer will help you assess what your risks are. But a lawyer will also never be able to say, go ahead and do it. They'll just help you make the decision, you know, help a project make a decision about what the risks are and whether it's worth taking it.
For example, when we sit down to record a podcast, we assess the risk that emergency vehicles are going to drive nearby the office. And oftentimes we are not successful at assessing that risk, as we just learned.
Twice in this particular podcast, we've had very loud sirens. Well, we appreciate you you sticking with us through the sirens to the end of this here podcast.
Ironically, a lot of sirens we ever had was when we recorded that one podcast in the hotel room in San Francisco. Go figure.
It's true.
If you want to get in touch with us, podcast@softwarefreedom.org. And I'm on the IRC channel every day, /SFLC on Freenode. Karen is there occasionally, but I'm there if I'm connected pretty much.
Send your end of the year donations to softwarefreedom.org/donate.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks, or hear you, talk to you, something like that.
See you then.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
I was surprised to hear you say that you didn't know the names of the patent cases, because you definitely know the names of those key patent cases.
I guess I could try to name them. Okay, well, there's Fluke, and then Diamond v. Deere, and then there's Benson, which is like Benson v. Krause, and then there's Hardcastle v. McCormick. There's Remington v. Steele, and then Cosby v. A Different World Incorporated, right?
Next you'll tell me that they were presided over by Judge Harry Stone.
They weren't?